Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week, we're looking at the portion of Matot, which goes from Numbers 30, verse 2, or verse 1 if you're reading a Christian translation, through 32:42. On some years, this portion is read along with the next portion, Maaseh. So be sure to check the pinned comment below to see if you should read both portions or just this one this week. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
In Matot, Moses instructs the people of Israel about taking and keeping vows, after which Israel takes vengeance on Midian for their role in leading Israel astray into judgment. And the tribes of Reuben and Gad receive their inheritance in the territory of Gilead, across the Jordan from Canaan.
So this portion begins with God talking to Moses and telling him about how the people of Israel need to keep their vows. He starts out by saying that if a man makes a vow to Adonai, or if he takes any other kind of binding oath or binding obligation on himself, then he needs to not violate his word and he needs to do whatever he said. There's no way to get out of that. He just has to do what he said. So this is pretty straightforward. It's just, if you promise you're going to do something, then you have to do it. Very obvious, and like we talked about in a previous portion where we were discussing Nazirite vows, which was a specific kind of vow that you would take onto yourself, we also discussed how Yeshua kind of expanded this concept to say, let your word be yes, yes, or no, no, which basically means even if you're not swearing, even if you're not making a vow or a promise, if you commit to doing something, then you should just do it. Your word should be your bond, and you should do whatever you say. Now, where things get a bit more complicated is that the Torah here says that there are different rules for women when they're taking vows. Basically, what it says is that under normal circumstances, a woman does have to keep her vow, but there are a few exceptions, namely when her father or her husband objects to the vow. Basically, it starts out by saying that if a woman is young and she's still living in her father's house, her father has the authority to cancel out his daughter's vow on the day that he hears it. If her father doesn't say anything, if he doesn't object, then the vow stands. But if he says, no, my daughter cannot keep this vow, then it says that Adonai will forgive her and she won't have to keep her vow. Likewise, the same kind of rules apply after the woman gets married, only this time instead of her father being able to cancel the vow, it's her husband being able to cancel the vow. Again, on the day that he hears about the vow, if he says, no, you cannot keep the vow, then God will forgive her and she won't have to go through with that vow. But interestingly, it specifies, if he doesn't annul the vow on the day that he hears it, and he allows it for a while, but then later, afterward, he does say, you can't keep this vow, then in that case, there has been sin, and it says that the husband will bear the guilt for his wife. So the husband should have, on the day that he heard about the vow, canceled it if he didn't want there to be a vow. But if he allows that to continue for a while, and then later he cancels it, then there has been guilt there. That vow was broken wrongfully, and the husband is responsible for that, not his wife. And then there's one more case that this passage mentions, which is that if a woman is a widow or she's divorced, then no one can cancel her vow. If she makes a vow, she has to fulfill that no matter what. She's not under the authority of her father, and she's not under the authority of her husband, so all of her vows stand.
So I think this passage reveals how God views the relationship between a father and his daughter and between a husband and his wife. We see that as long as a woman is unmarried, she remains in her father's house, under her father's authority. We've seen this before, all the way back in Genesis, how the father kind of has authority over his daughter until he hands her off to a husband. So until a father marries off his daughter, he has responsibility and authority over his daughter. On the one hand, this means the daughter has to break her vows if her father tells her to. But it also means that the father can protect his daughter from making rash vows. And that if she does break her vows because her father forces her to, she's not responsible and God's not going to hold it against her. So this isn't just some kind of overbearing, oppressive requirement being put on women that you have to violate your vows whenever the man in authority over you tells you to. This is actually giving more leniency to the woman, giving a provision so that if she does make a rash vow, her father or later her husband can protect her from that by annulling the vow. And so it's in this sense that we see that it's not just about the woman being submitted to her father or submitted to her husband, but about her father or her husband leading her in a way that takes care of her and protects her and is responsible for her well-being. And Paul actually elaborates on this relationship between husband and wife by comparing it to the relationship between Messiah and the body of believers. He instructs the believers, saying, "The wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands, as to the master, because the husband is head of the wife, as also the Messiah is head of the called forth. As the called forth is submitted to Messiah, so also are the wives submitted to the husbands in everything." But then he tells the husbands, "Love the wives, as the Messiah also loved the called forth, and gave himself for her, so that he might set her apart. In this same way, the husbands also ought to love their own wives as their own bodies, as the Messiah also loves the called forth, since we are members of his body. Let each and every one of you in this way love his own wife as himself, and the wife see that she respects the husband." So Paul's instruction here is saying, on the one hand, that wives need to be submitted to their husband's authority. They have to do what their husband says and respect their husband. It's just like what the Torah is saying. The husband's authority is over the wife, even trumping her own vows to God. And yet this authority is not given to the husband just to use willy-nilly, and is not a means by which to oppress women. On the contrary, the husbands are supposed to love their wives as they love themselves, and so take care of their wives as they would take care of their own bodies. And so if the wife is submitted to the husband as she should be, then this allows the husband to take care of his wife as he would take care of himself. If he wouldn't take a vow because he thinks it's rash, he can prevent his wife from taking that vow. Not because he wants to subdue her, but because he wants to protect her. He wants her to be able to live as well as he himself lives. So even though the relationship between husband and wife is not one of equal authority, it's nonetheless one which is equally beneficial and blessing to both sides, even putting more obligation and more responsibility on the husband. The rules regarding vows are harsher for the husband than they are for the wife, because as God entrusts more authority, he also expects more responsibility.
I find it very interesting here that it basically is putting this same kind of authority for a husband over his wife versus a father over his daughter. It's showing a similar kind of the husband needs to protect and guard and lead his wife in the same way that a father needs to guard and protect and lead his whole household, including his children. Just as there's no problem with a father having authority over his children, there's also no problem with a husband having authority over his wife, as long as the father and the husband are using their authority well for the well-being and the benefit of their children and of their wives. And I also just wanted to note here that in this passage, it specifically talks about three different instances for a woman in relation to her vows. There's a woman who's under the authority of her father because she hasn't married yet. There's a woman who's under the authority of her husband because she has married. And then there's also a woman who's not under any man's authority because she's a widow or she's divorced, so her marriage has been broken. Nowhere in this passage does it describe a virgin woman who's living on her own. Of course, there could be exceptions to this, like if a woman was orphaned or something like that. We actually saw earlier in the book of Numbers, there were five different sisters who their father had died, and so they didn't have any man over them. But in most cases, it's not normal for a woman to be living on her own without the authority of a man over her. So it's not a normal thing for a woman to just say, "All right, Dad, I'm moving out, I'm leaving, and I'm going to live on my own." Biblically speaking, a woman should usually have the protection of a man over her, whether that protection being the covering of her father or of her husband. In either way, the woman has that authority of a man over her, a man who loves her and protects her and cherishes her and leads her in the way that she should go.
So at this point, God says to Moses, it is time for Israel to avenge themselves on the Midianites. In the last few portions, we read about how Moab and Midian were conspiring to undermine Israel, They recruited the prophet Balaam and tried to have him curse Israel, and when that failed, they instead resolved to draw Israel away from following God by the women enticing Israel into sexual immorality and idolatry. As a result of Midian doing this and leading Israel astray, a plague broke out in Israel which killed 24,000 people. So Midian didn't go out to battle against Israel because they knew that Adonai was with Israel. But by leading Israel astray from Adonai, they were able to kill a bunch of Israelites. And God holds that against Midian and has already told Israel that they were supposed to avenge Midian. And now God is saying, it's time. We are going to avenge them for their work in getting a bunch of Israelites killed. So Moses assembles 1,000 men out of each tribe of Israel, making 12,000 in all, and he sends Phinehas the priest, who was the one who had stopped the plague, to lead the army with the vessels of the sanctuary and with the trumpets for alarm. And it says that the army of Israel was so successful that they killed every male in Midian. This includes the 5 kings of Midian and also Balaam himself. Mm. Even though Balaam wasn't a Midianite, it was Balaam who had joined with the Midianites in trying to undermine Israel. And even though he couldn't curse Israel, it was his idea for the Midianite women to entice Israel into sexual immorality and idolatry. And so because of Balaam's role in that, Balaam ended up getting killed along with the Midianites. So after wiping out all the fighting men of Midian, they take all the women and children and all their cattle and all their belongings as plunder and spoil, and they bring them back to the camp.
Now, even though the people of Israel fought when God commanded them to fight, and they killed all of the fighting men of Midian, so they had total victory, even though this was the case, it says that Moses actually got angry with them when they got back. And the reason is because they didn't kill enough people. Moses says, why did you spare the women? You need to kill the women too. Moses explains that the reason for this is because it was the women who were responsible for drawing Israel away. So the women weren't guiltless, innocent bystanders in this case. They were an active threat to the people of Israel. And so, just like how the fighting men of Midian needed to be killed because they were a threat to Israel, in the same way, the women and also the male children, they needed to be killed as well to basically stop Midian from ever being a threat to Israel again. The only people who are spared are the young virgin women of the people of Midian. They're taken as part of the spoils of war, and they are distributed throughout the people of Israel, presumably as slaves or possibly as concubines. The virgin women would be the only women who were not involved in leading Israel astray. And so they are the only ones who get to escape from this attack with their lives because they weren't involved in the sin that incurred this attack.
Israel's vengeance on Midian here is very violent and brutal and deadly. But it's put into perspective when you realize that the Midianites are not innocent. The Midianites are responsible for the death of 24,000 Israelis. And meanwhile, the Midianites are still looming right there, continuing to be a threat to Israel. So this was not just a willy-nilly, we're going to go kill some people. This was explicitly God's instruction for dealing with this specific case of people who wanted to see Israel dead. Mm. For people who intend brutal violence to Israel, God may inflict brutal violence defending his people. Mm. And he may inflict that violence through his people. And ironically, this is in fulfillment of exactly what Balaam said, echoing the words that God spoke to Abraham, "Blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you." Even after Balaam uttered those words that God put in his mouth, Midian chose to set themselves up against Israel for harm, and it was Midian who ended up getting cursed. And Israel is the one who comes out of this with plunder. Tons and tons of plunder, as we're about to see. So the more Israel's enemies try to attack them, the more Israel is blessed, and the more Israel's enemies are cursed. Because God is always with Israel in the midst of their enemies.
But I do want to point out that Israel doesn't always have victory against their enemies. We saw back in the early chapters of Numbers that the people of Israel tried to fight against the Canaanites and conquer the land of Israel when God hadn't commanded them to. God had cursed them and said, "You are forbidden from entering the land until the next generation comes. But this generation, because you were unfaithful, you are banished from the land." And when the people of Israel tried to fight when God said don't, they ended up getting killed. They failed miserably and the Canaanites won. But in this case, the people of Israel were acting exactly in accordance with God's will. We saw that God was the one who said to Moses, "It's time to take vengeance on the Midianites." We saw that Phinehas the priest was bringing the trumpets of alarm with him when they went out to fight against the Midianites. We had read previously in the book of Numbers that the silver trumpets were supposed to be sounded whenever Israel went to war against their enemies, and then God would remember them and they would be saved from their enemies. So they were following that command. The priests were blowing the trumpets just like they should. And then again, even after the victory, we see that it was at Moses' command that they killed the women and the male children. They didn't do that of their own accord. They did it when they were commanded to. And again, after they had done all that, it says that Moses told them to purify themselves from dead bodies on the third and the seventh day, which matches the commands that they were given regarding the red heifer cleansing for people who have touched dead human bodies. So even after that, they were following those commands as well. In all of these instances, this generation of Israelis is following God's commands to a T, this being after they disobeyed God when Midian led them astray. Now that God is commanding them, you need to avenge yourselves on Midian, they are following God's commands as they should. And that's why they're seeing so much victories, because God is with them. And so when God commands the people of Israel to completely conquer or wipe out another nation, God will give the people of Israel the power to do that. And he will spare them from harm and give them everything that they need. And I also want to point out that Moses specifically tells them to wipe out all of the women who had led the people of Israel astray. So not just the fighting men who were a physical danger to the people, but also the whoring women who could draw Israel astray from God's commands and from God himself. And so this shows that there was a deeper danger here than just the danger of a foreign military looming at your doorstep. This was a spiritual danger that needed to be dealt with so that the people of Israel couldn't be led astray again. And I think that we should use this as a picture for how zealously we should be trying to root out the dangerous influences in our lives, the sinful, fleshly, lusting influences that could draw us astray from God's word. Yeshua says that if your eye or your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, pluck it out or cut it off and throw it away from you, because it's better to enter into eternal life maimed than it is to go to hell. And so we see that even if it's at great cost to ourselves, we need to do whatever it takes to stay on the path. If there's a temptation or an influence or a relationship or anything like that that is in our lives and is continually pulling us away from God, we can't just push it away to arm's length. We need to completely cut it off so that it can't come back into our lives at all. Even if it seems drastic, even if it seems impossible, we need to do whatever it takes to make sure that those influences don't come back into our lives again. It's sort of like how if you're an alcoholic, you can never, ever, ever go back to even having a drop of alcohol again, because you could go back into your alcoholism. In the same way for our sin, if there's a really sinful influence in our lives, we need to cut it off forever, not even entertain going back to it, or we will be drawn astray again.
We see that Israel had already completely defeated the Midianites and taken all the women captive and all the plunder and burned all their cities. They had defeated Midian. And yet, in the very same act by which they vanquished their enemy, they also allowed the hostile influence to come into their camp. So this also shows that we need to not get complacent. We need to not think we've dealt with bad influence in our life. We've dealt with a sin we've been struggling with. We've overcome temptation, and so now we have nothing to worry about. When God gives us victory over evil in our lives, that is not the time to become complacent. That is the time to stay focused on God, say, "What do you want me to do now?" And keep focused on the path, go forward toward Him, make him the goal, and not start accepting new influences into our lives, new temptations, because we think we've overcome the sin. We will never be strong enough that suddenly it's okay to have temptation in our lives. Because put simply, we're human. We have flesh. We have desires. And wherever there's desire and there's temptation, sin can be conceived. So we have to get the temptation out of our lives. Even if there's no sin in our lives, even if we think we've won, the battle's not over until we've reached the finish line. And the best way to avoid that complacency is to recognize that we shouldn't rely on ourselves or our own ability to overcome temptation, but rely on God as the one who has delivered us from evil, as the one who has given us the path to him and to life. So now God tells Moses to count up the plunder that they won from the people of Midian. And they're going to divide the plunder up into various parts. A portion for the army, a portion for the people, a portion for the Levites, and a portion for the priests. Now it says that the spoil that the people of Israel won was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 people. That's the virgin women that they kept alive. And keep in mind that this was an army of 12,000 Israelis. The number of captives they took is more than double the size of the army itself, not to mention all the people that they defeated in war. And in terms of the animals, that's more than one sheep per person for the entire massive assembly of Israel. So the spoils that the army of Israel won here is really unfathomable, and it shows what a great victory God gave to Israel.
And we're not even done yet, because it says that after they count up all of the spoils, it says that the soldiers all count themselves. They take a census of all the different soldiers who went out. And it says, no man of us is missing. In other words, every single Israeli soldier is accounted for. Not a single one of them died. They killed every single male and every single grown woman from the people of Midian, and not a single Israeli died. So not only has God given Israel massive victory, but it was at the expense of nothing of the people of Israel. All they had to do was follow God, and God just delivered everything straight into their hands. And it says that the soldiers, they recognize that God did this for them. And so when they see that not a single one of them died, they bring an offering to God from all of their gold and stuff that they found. They bring 16,750 shekels of gold, and they give it to Moses and Eleazar the priest, and they take it to the treasury of the tabernacle. So I think that this is another great example for us, which is that when we see that God has given something to us, then our immediate response should be to thank God and then to give back to God. God gave these men all of the spoils of this war. He said, this is the portion for the soldiers. They can have all of it. And so they weren't obligated to give all of this to God, but they felt compelled to. They did it anyway because they realized we didn't get this for ourselves. God gave this to us. And so whenever God gives something to us, we should give it back. Even if technically God has given something to us and it's ours now, in reality, God gave it to us and it is his because we are his. Everything we are is his. Everything we have is his. And so our immediate response to anything good that God does for us is to give back to him. In fact, our response to anything, whether we're experiencing plenty or little, whether we're experiencing good times or bad times, anytime anything happens, our response should be, how can we serve God with this? How can we please God? How can we give ourselves to God for what he's done for us?
Yeah, in this story, we see Israel not only following God's instructions and receiving God's blessings, but then being faithful with God's blessings. They took all that plunder and all those captives, but even after that, even after they had had the victory, they were faithful to deal with what they had received in the way God instructed. And then they were faithful to divide the plunder in the way God said. And then on top of that, they were faithful to bless God with the blessings that he had given to them by giving this gift of over 15,000 shekels of gold. God's abundant blessings to Israel are returned with abundant blessings to God.
So finally, this portion wraps up by talking about the tribes of Reuben and Gad asking Moses for a specific portion of land. So we had read in a previous portion that some nations had attacked the people of Israel, and God's response was to tell Israel, go ahead and attack them back, and go ahead and conquer all of their land. And so even though the people of Israel haven't entered the land of Canaan yet, they haven't gone into the promised land, the people of Israel are now in possession of some land. And so it says that the tribes of Reuben and Gad saw that the land that they had conquered was actually really fertile and was a great place for raising livestock. And the tribes of Gad and Reuben had tons and tons of livestock, apparently. And so these two tribes approach Moses and ask, can we please have this land? This land is later called Gilead. And they're asking, can we please have the land of Gilead instead of part of the land of Canaan? Because this is such a good, fertile place for our livestock. And Moses' immediate response is to kind of flip out, because we had seen in the previous generation, they got to the edge of the promised land, and then the people of Israel said, we don't want to go in, we're discouraged, we don't want to go in. And so then they ended up being banished from the land for 40 years, and they all died, and it was horrible. And so Moses basically goes into a rant recounting all of that, and then he says, you're sinners just like your fathers, you're evil, why are you doing this? You're basically saying that you'll just sit here in the land we've already conquered while the rest of the people is going to conquer the land of Canaan. You're going to be at rest and at peace while your brothers are going to war. How dare you? And more than that, you're going to discourage the people of Israel from going to conquer the land of Canaan. Just like how the spies earlier in the book of Numbers discouraged the people from going to conquer Canaan and saying, we can't conquer it. You're going to discourage the people of Israel by saying, this land is fruitful, so we don't need to go to the promised land. So at this point, Gad and Reuben are like, wait, hold up. We aren't saying that we're going to abandon the rest of the people of Israel. What we're proposing is that we go ahead and start building cities and settling our families here in Gilead. But then when it's time for all the people to start conquering the land of Canaan, we'll leave our families behind, but our fighting men will go into Canaan with the other tribes. Basically, we aren't going to abandon our brothers. We're going to fight alongside them, and then we aren't going to go and return to our families in Gilead until all the Canaanites have been dispersed and the people of Israel have settled in the land of Canaan. We won't have rest until our brothers have rest, but we still want to end up living out here in Gilead because it's really fertile and nice. And so Moses is like, well, if you're sure, if you're going to definitely go to war with them, if you're not going to abandon them, then okay, I guess you can have Gilead, but make sure you go and fight alongside the rest of the tribes. And then it says that Moses calls over Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and all of the heads of the different fathers' houses in the people of Israel. And he calls them over and says, make sure these guys fight alongside the rest of the people of Israel. If they don't, then force them to live in Canaan, not in Gilead. But if they do fight alongside you, then fine, they can go and live in Gilead like they want. Okay.
I find this interesting that Moses is saying to Joshua and Eleazar, if Reuben and Gad won't fight for Canaan, then they'll have to live in Canaan. But if they do fight for Canaan, then they don't have to live in Canaan. It's kind of ironic, but it shows Reuben and Gad need to fight alongside the people of Israel because they're putting the needs of Israel above their own needs. Yes, the tribes of Reuben and Gad don't need the land of Canaan because they could settle in Gilead, but Canaan is still the promised land, and that's still where Israel needs to settle, and the other tribes don't have a home yet. So Reuben and Gad need to, not for their own sake, but for the sake of their brothers, participate in taking the land of Canaan. And if they're not going to help their brothers get that land flowing with milk and honey, they're not going to get to settle where they want to settle either. But interestingly, by this request of Reuben and Gad to settle in Gilead instead of Canaan, they're actually enlarging Israel's territory. Instead of cramming all 12 tribes into Canaan, this arrangement lets some of the tribes settle in Gilead and some others settle in Canaan, such that overall, the inheritances for each tribe is bigger. Everyone has more room. The whole nation has more land. So actually, this request doesn't just benefit Reuben and Gad. It benefits the entire people of Israel.
And I also want to point out that Reuben and Gad didn't make this a demand. They came and asked Moses for permission. And in turn, God ended up blessing that and giving territory to Reuben and Gad. And also for part of the tribe of Manasseh, they decided to stay over in Gilead as well. But overall, they weren't doing this out of rebellion to God, and they were presenting their request to God. They weren't demanding for themselves, but they were putting this proposition before Moses and getting him to agree to it, so that even when they were doing something that benefited themselves, they weren't doing it contrary to God's will. And even though God gave the land of Gilead to the people of Israel, even though he delivered their enemies into their hands and gave this really fertile place to Gad and Reuben and part of Manasseh, that didn't give Reuben and Gad and part of Manasseh the license to sit back and relax and rest in their possessions. They already have their inheritances now, but that doesn't mean that they can get to rest and stop in their inheritance. They instead have to fight alongside their brothers until they can claim their inheritances as well. And so I think that this just goes to show that God doesn't give us blessings and provision and such just so that we can sit back and enjoy it. He expects us to help others too, to meet their needs as well. Just because God meets our needs doesn't mean that we can ignore the other people around us. In fact, it would be wrong to sit back and enjoy what God has given us while we know we are able to help the people around us and we are not doing that. So whether God gives us a lot or he gives us a little, we should always put the needs of other people first. We should seek to see how we can help other people. Even if we have everything we need, we should be making sure that everyone else has everything that they need too, before we then start to sit back and relax and enjoy what God has given to us.
So I think the takeaway from this portion is that we need to keep our obligations to God and to each other. Moses told the people of Israel that whenever any man made a vow, he was binding himself to that vow. He was putting an obligation on himself, and he had to fulfill it. He could not break his word. And this was whether it was a vow to God or just any vow in general. We also see that God laid an obligation on the people of Israel to avenge themselves on Midian, to fight all the men and all the women who were involved in leading Israel astray, and to leave none of them alive. And by following through on that obligation, they received God's blessings. But then they were obligated to distribute those blessings the way God commanded. And finally, the tribes of Reuben and Gad had an obligation to help their brothers take the land of Canaan, even if they were going to settle in the land of Gilead. No matter what God gives to us, no matter how blessed we are, or if our circumstances are hard, or if they're good, if we have much, or if we have little, we should always be keeping our obligations, doing what God expects of us, and doing what we can to help one another. So not just focusing on our own needs, but on what we need to do for God and on what we can do for others.
That wraps up the portion of Matot. Next time we'll be looking at the portion of Maaseh, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next time. God bless.